You're listening to a podcast from Oasis Church Waterloo. To find out more, visit oasiswaterloo.org.
Welcome. Thanks for coming all this way over from America just for this one service.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, really privileged of that. Tell us why you are in the UK. It's not just for us. I'm sorry to tell you that.
It's not. I was originally here. I was speaking at a conference in Oxford on mysticism. So London was tagged on to the end of that trip by my publisher, but I'm grateful to be here.
We are really grateful to have you. Looking out into this room, I can already see the number of a load of faces of people who have, at various points over the last few years, said, have you seen that Instagram thing, Black Liturgies? It's amazing. And my response is, yeah, it's amazing. And what I want to say is, yeah, I read it all the time to try and steal ideas for prayers for church, which I feel like is probably what lots of churches are going through at the moment. So we know a little bit about you, and we know a little bit about Black Liturgies. But for those of you, for those of us who don't know so much about that, could you tell us a little bit about that? But also, what was life before Black Liturgies?
Before Black Liturgies, I was working in partnership with an organization that did work with students at a university called Cornell in the States. And so mostly doing spiritual formation with students and reading a lot of books and getting paid to read a lot of books. I wasn't raised in a religious tradition. I wasn't raised as a Christian or anything like that, and began attending Christian services in college really for the first time consistently. And it was after college that I first fell in love with liturgy, which is a weird way to say it. I was exhausted. I was looking for a way to survive spiritually in a season of a lot of sadness and exhaustion. And I found liturgy, meaning kind of a written form for connecting with God or the divine, I found liturgy to be a real haven and a real place of rest for me. Fast forward to the summer of 2020, which was an utter lack of rest for many of us. It was the first summer of the pandemic. We were in lockdown. We also were grieving the deaths of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and the world appeared to be prepared to kind of contend with historic anti-blackness. And that summer, I was looking for a liturgy that felt capable of speaking to the Black interior world in a way that felt honest. And the Book of Common Prayer, which I find so much beauty in, just simply isn't that artifact for me. So I began Black Liturgies.
I might ask you to read something, if that's okay. This is something that you wrote for Palm Sunday, and there's a question I'd like to ask you which ties into what you just said, and also to this prayer as well.
Yes. God of the palms, thank you for drawing near to us. We have known what it is to encounter help that isn't truly help. We have known white savior complexes and the narrative of white heroism, which has always secretly delighted in suffering, so it might be the hero again and again. Thank you for showing us a different way, a God who rejects privilege, a God who is unbothered by sitting on a donkey if it means you are drawing near to us. As we wait, take away the fear that has settled on our souls. Help us to trust in the arrival of goodness, even in the wake of suffering. Let this Palm Sunday speak the language of welcome, that we would never turn hope away when it appears to us. Amen.
Amen. You should keep the microphone. I'll take the book back. So I heard you interviewed by a mutual friend of ours, Ginny MacDonald, and you said in there that part of the reason, I might be misquoting here, but to paraphrase, part of the reason that Black Liturgy started was after the George Floyd death and all the stuff that you've just talked about. You felt like you needed to, you couldn't go to a church and listen to a lovely old white woman, but an old white woman. You couldn't listen to her pray because basically she wouldn't get it. And that was part of the reasoning for starting Black Liturgies. And I asked you to read this bit, particularly then. There's a lot in this, which is, you said, we've known white saviour complexes and the narrative of white heroism. Has it surprised you then, given where Black Liturgy started and some of the ways in which you write these prayers, has it surprised you how many white people have resonated with all of these prayers that you've written?
Yes. It definitely did originally. So I began Black Liturgies as a digital project. So I was sharing kind of written prayers and breath exercises and connecting them with the Black literary tradition online. And, you know, the purpose is in the name, Black Liturgies. So initially I was quite surprised to see how fast it was growing outside of Black people. But in hindsight, I'm in a way not surprised. I think, or I hope, anytime you're writing something honest, that would draw people into some kind of honesty in themselves. And, you know, if I have something to learn from James Joyce, you know, and the interior worlds that he writes about, then can white people have something to learn from Black interiority? I think yes, and that maybe there's some mystical healing that happens when white people are forced to pray words written out of the Black interior world, words that don't center them and aren't necessarily about them, but that hopefully there can be truth located in.
Amazing, thank you. I'm just going to change tack a little bit. When I was talking this week, so Oasis runs churches in Bath and in Hull in the northeast of England, and also in Reading, and there's a lot from the Reading lot at the back here. And so I was talking to the leaders of these churches during the week, and Claire, who leads Oasis Church Hull, she said that she bought this book, Black Liturgies, and she said that they had somebody who came to their church who had come out of a fairly conservative church, and she had recommended this book to this new lady who had joined this church. And then this lady had said that there is some swearing in one of the prayers. And Claire's question for you via me is it okay to swear when you pray?
I mean, it's funny that you ask, because I honestly couldn't tell you where in the book I swear. So I suppose that means that truly is from an honest place in my inner life, because I didn't notice. I think if it is true to your experience and to your emotional expression, who am I to say that you can't swear? If we are people who are claiming to any level of belief in this kind of supernatural, mystical God, I would hope that God has an imagination for why someone like us would need to curse at times, need to swear, need to emphasize, and that they wouldn't be threatened by that. Of course, there's a time and the place, so do what feels right for your communities and, you know.
I remember somebody telling me, I think it's okay because God's heard all the words before, which I quite like. Let's take one of the questions from Mentimeter. This is a great one. I was going to ask about this as well. Please, can you explain something more about prayers and breathing practices? So at the end of you can explain. Explain more about, without me trying to set up the question any further, explain more about prayers and breathing practices.
Yes. So again, I started Black Liturgies online and was in part horrified by the mode I had chosen and the ways that social media really thrives and succeeds by our own disembodiment, something that I've tried to resist in my life and my friends and I try to encourage each other not to participate in. And so I started to use breath as a form of prayer, hopefully as a way to subvert that, to subvert the disembodiment that comes with mindlessly scrolling, and hoping that maybe there are people who pause and really are breathing together, you know, across screens. And I think many of us know what it is to exist far from our own bodies, to kind of put our embodied needs, or the corporeal in any sense, the physical, as secondary to what people have told us is the spiritual. And in my work, part of what I'm trying to reclaim is what many Black theologians and frankly Black fiction writers, Black writers in general have said, which is the physical is the spiritual. My body is a part of, a part of my connection to the divine, and no less credible, breath is no less credible a prayer as kind of written articulation.
And then, does that then lead through to the way you write? Because I'm interested in the style of your writing. There's a stillness, I think, a slowness in your writing, in that it's impossible to read these things quickly. Do you think that comes out? Is that a deliberate thing that you try to write with that kind of the attention to slow people down so that they get towards those breathing exercises at the end of those things?
It's not deliberate, no, but thank you. I think I am a bit of a slow soul. I move slow. I speak slowly, typically. And I tend to be quite careful about my words. And I think that comes through in my writing voice. Whether I'm writing prayers or whether I'm writing fiction, there's kind of this slowness to it. Maybe that's just because that's how I appear on the inside, and it's making its way to the page.
Another one from Mentivita. What's your advice to young people who are facing a world in despair to not be overwhelmed by the pain that they encounter, but live with joy and with purpose?
I'll say two things. One will sound cynical, maybe cynical, but it's not. I'll use two Black thinkers. The first occurred in an interview with Toni Morrison, where the interviewer asked her, how do you survive whole in a world in which we're all victims of something, and seemingly all of the time? And Morrison says, sometimes you don't, and that sometimes you don't survive whole. And she says, the beauty of life is in that attempt, the attempt toward survival and goodness and beauty in a world that, you know, of course, is trying to degrade it. I find a lot of liberation in that, because I hadn't yet heard someone articulate that, that sometimes the world takes something from you that you don't get back. And that's painful, and that's just what we have to live. The beauty of life is in the attempt. I'll couple that with a more maybe, I don't want to call it hopeful, that seems trite, but in an interview with James Baldwin, he was asked by this interviewer, are you still in despair of the world? And he gives the interviewer this strangest look, and he says, despair? I've never been in despair of the world. He says, enraged. I've been enraged by the world, but never despair. And he says, you can't tell the children there's no hope. And I like that call to attune to the emotion, the grief, the rage of a world that does not care for us often, does not care well for us often, while acknowledging that hopelessness serves no one. There's a poet, Cornelius Eady, who says, cynicism is a form of obedience. And basically says, that's in service to the status quo. Your despair, your hopelessness, your cynicism, saying this is the way it's going to be, this is how it will always be, it only serves the oppressor. And there are many of us who just cannot afford it. We can't afford despair.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you to read another one now. This is kind of following on from that question, really, about giving advice to young people. This is for Black women who were taught they were responsible for saving the world.
Thank you for choosing this one. Sacred peace. We're not saving this. Too often we are expected to rescue the world from its own ugliness, to save our communities, our elections, our churches, our relationships, our men. We are used as teacher, prophet, priest, and therapist, all without compensation. We are tired. Let us reclaim ourselves. Help us to resist a society that uses Black women to alleviate its own guilt, expose those in our lives who see us as more resource than human, show the world the ways it uses us as mere tools for others' own self-realization. We don't want to be bridges, trampled on daily so that folks can be guided across deep waters without ever getting wet. We want to be human, whole, complicated, rested, and well. We want more for ourselves, more rest, more laughter, more play, more adventure. Be our peace in a desperate world. Ase. I don't want to speak. I don't want to use this mic. I can't.
So I love that. I just wondered, though, do you feel any of that burden now? Because, you know, you spend a lot of time now touring around, speaking, and when you do, you get asked things like, what advice have you got for young people? Do you feel anything about that?
I do a bit, yes. I feel a bit of pressure at times. I'm quite young. I'm only 33. And I think because I share very little of myself on social media, there can be a idealization that happens, and this weird kind of interpretation of me as like some sage, and really I'm 33 and I ate chips for breakfast, and people should encounter my words with that in mind. So I feel a little bit of pressure, but also I live a very quiet life when I'm not touring. I live on about 8 acres in a pretty rural area. None of my friends care. None of my friends, they don't care that I'm sitting in front of audiences or that I wrote a best-selling book. They just care if I've eaten today. You know, they want to know how long I slept last night. And so in that way, you can surround yourself by community that is a bit unimpressed with you. And not in a deprecating way, but meaning I can exist and not feel so much pressure to save and just belong to a community.
Mm, yeah, that's important. Maybe that's what you need to change your Instagram bio to. I'm 33 and I eat chips for breakfast. Maybe that'll do some
that
of the work
help,
for
yeah.
you. Yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask a couple of questions about social media, one of which has come through the Menti link. How do you feel about the vehicle of social media where most people interact with your work, tending towards consumption versus faith in action?
Yeah, it's complicated. It's definitely more complicated as the Instagram account in particular has grown. And there was a point where maybe we were kind of siloed, our community. We were kind of siloed and isolated, and there was a lot more sincere connection happening in comments. And then the algorithm does what the algorithm does, and I've benefited from it. But all of a sudden, there are all kinds of people in the space with all kinds of expectations for what my work should look like. So it's complicated. There's some level of consumption that's necessary, but I try my best to kind of focus or create not a sense of me as some distant, I'm trying, not a sense of me as some distant figure who's kind of offering this, but as a true sense of mutuality, where if someone disagrees in a comment, I'm not gonna be threatened by that. You know, I'm like, oh, tell me more. Share it to me why you think this is, you know, reverse racism or whatever. And the less threatened you try to be, I think the more you can kind of spare yourself that consumer dynamic of, I'm up here giving you this and you're coming. Also, I just ignore a lot of people. and that helps. People that see me as kind of more resource than human, I just tend not to reply. I think that's okay.
Yeah, that's definitely the way to do it. Yeah. By the way, I was going to ask you to read something else, and in doing so, I found the sweary one.
There it is.
There you go. Yes. Yeah, it's a proper. It's a real one as well. It's not one of the ones you get away with at 9 o'clock, you know. I was going to ask you. So part of what I'm really interested in, I said this to Cole earlier when we were just chatting before the service, that I think I probably followed Black Liturgies for a good few months before realizing that it was one person who was putting all this together. I just assumed it was coming out of a church, there was a team of people, whatever it might be. And you've talked a couple of times about how you have kind of retreated almost, or you kind of deliberately tried to stay away from putting yourself out there. And so I wondered if you might read, "For a World Where Children Have to Practice Hiding Under Their Desks." And then the breathing exercise that comes after that. And I have a question about linking those two things.
Divine protector, our world is plagued with unimaginable evil that destroys the most innocent among us. Make our anger loud. Never let us become comfortable with hearing that children have been sacrificed on the altars of our own distorted political agendas. Disrupt the politicization of mass murder and hold the enablers of school shootings to account. Make way for the emotional healing of victims, families, and all those who have been conditioned to expect horror. Cultivate communities who untangle the distorted reality that white supremacy has instilled in its youth, a distortion that says it's normal to brace for death so young, to know which desk to hide under. Guard the minds and hearts of children for whom safety is foreign, and remind us that raising children is a communal responsibility, that their lives depend on not just our grief, but a righteous rage that leads to action. When we say never again, may we mean it. Amen. And here are a few breath practices following that section. This is the section on rage. There is space for my anger. Inhale. Exhale, my pain won't be dismissed. Inhale, I will not grow numb. Exhale, there is beauty in anger. Inhale, my truth-telling is a gift. Exhale, I am free to say so.
I guess my question is around the balance between wanting to use your public voice to make changes here, but also wanting to be able to retreat and have that space to yourself. Do you find that balance difficult?
A bit at times, yes. I think of it as kind of the contemplative in me. This kind of is the conference that I was just a part of. We talked a lot about this. The contemplative in me, which wants to kind of meditate and think and maybe stare at a wall for far too long, I think needs to be rightfully balanced and balance with a real awareness and commitment to the exterior world. I think I talk a lot about Black interiority, but if we're all just inside ourselves all day long, it's not going to be helpful to one another. We're not actually going to meet each other's faces. And so I think what you're articulating is that balance between maybe contemplation and action, which people have said is an impossible thing to achieve. You know, the contemplative can never be an activist. But I think we have theologians and mystics like Howard Thurman, who have shown us it's absolutely compatible, that one's interior journey should absolutely draw them into the very real, kind of what you were talking about, the real and tangible present injustices that are around us every day.
Just going through loads of questions here. How should a church like ours use liturgy, and specifically Black liturgy and writings, within their settings, and how important is this?
Can you say the first part of that
question? So how should a church like ours use liturgy, and specifically Black liturgy and writings?
That's a very good question. I should have an answer, but I don't. I don't really have an answer for how the book should be used. My publisher would probably not love that answer. I think it can be used in the kind of personal and the individual setting. The first section is by story, and so it takes you through these different shared human experiences, like rage, like lament, like mortality, like selfhood, and I think those can be encountered alone. The second section, I think there are more opportunities for kind of a communal structure, a communal engagement. There's more call and response type prayers in there, and I think Yeah, I think whatever feels safe, depending on who's in the room, and I don't know this particular room, so there might be a small group, for example, where you feel safe going to places like anger or mortality in a way that you wouldn't in a room of this size. So, yes, use your own discernment.
What about... this is about four questions rolled in together now, but with the we did say we're going to try and finish this by 20 past 12, so we might have to do like part A, part B, part C versions of these questions. But there's quite a few responses around things like you. When we talked about how Black Liturgy started after you said you found it difficult to go to a church and listen to a lovely old white woman pray. Now, at that same weekend that you were in that church, I was here and I was leading prayers for racial justice. Now, there's quite a lot of questions around that. I understand the critique around, you know, what you're saying around not being able to go to a church where a white person is leading that. So how is there a way in which we as a probably a white majority church could do a better job around that? And the caveat to this question obviously comes with the fact that I remember a friend of mine asking a very similar question, a white friend of mine asking a very similar question of a black friend, and the black friend's response was, oh yeah, there's a really important black theologian who would say, do your own effing reading.
Well, I'll say to that moment where I was, this was the Sunday after George Floyd's murder went viral, it was Pentecost Sunday, I believe, and it was an Anglican church service. So the woman, it was less her identity and more the text that she was operating out of, which of course was the Book of Common Prayer. The Book of Common Prayer, which has been a harbor to me, but I know what was happening to my ancestors in the 16th century when Thomas Cranmer wrote the Book of Common Prayer. And I, because of that, there's this limit. And I know, you know, there was certainly a limit to his own imagination for my inner life. And so the kind of hunger, well, first I'll say, I don't really think the Book of Common Prayer needs to apologize for itself, or that white prayer needs to apologize for itself necessarily by virtue of it being white. I think I'm more interested in complicating some of our prayer experiences and being in a place where we can say there are some seasons where it's just hard to pray words written by a white man, and can we let that be okay? And so I don't think it requires churches to completely upheave their liturgies or their prayer systems. You can, if that feels right to the people it belongs to, but I think it's more a question of, is this liturgy something that I can approach? Does it feel honest and credible to my own experience? And while I'm grieving a slew of very public black deaths and surrounded by this new kind of sinister appetite for black pain that came out of 2020, I didn't want to be near the Book of Common Prayer. And I think that's okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Great question. Thank you for your liturgy about black women. As a black woman working in racial justice, self-care is a priority. Apart from chips for breakfast, how do you work to keep whole?
Yeah, my friends who are like, have you eaten? They would not be happy to learn that I ate chips for breakfast. But I have to do a lot of very practical things. I lived disembodied for so long for a number of reasons, anti-blackness being just one of those many reasons. But I lived away from my body, or numbing the body, for so long that now I can only survive by these little alarms I set. So I set alarms to remind me to look up from my computer screen. Every 20 minutes is the doctor's order. Apparently every 20 minutes you should look up from your screen 20 feet away for 20 seconds. I set alarms on my phone to do that. I practice a lot of breath practice myself, and I deal with chronic illness and have for some years, and so I'm limited in kind of expressions of the body in this season, but breath has for me personally been one kind of accessible, still accessible route. But yes, I think really community is everything. If you're surrounded by people, or if you have some people close to you who just will not tolerate your bodily neglect, your self-neglect, I think that goes way past any alarm you can set, way past just trying to muster the strength to care for yourself. I think community care is really... yeah, it's really the best and the clearest way to be reminded and have eyes that are on you.
Leading on from that, I wondered if you might read for the disabled and chronically ill.
Yes. God of every ache, help us to befriend our bodies. We confess that it is easy to turn against them as the source of our struggle. Awaken a compassion, a tenderness toward the parts of us that are changing or hurting, remembering that our bodies are doing everything they can to protect us, that our bodies are fighting and trying their best to hold back the pain and exhaustion. And with every ailing and unseen thing, guide us toward those capable of listening and perceiving when we are not okay, that we wouldn't feel pressure to pretend or apologize or explain, but could exist in the truth of what we need. Remind us that we are not a burden, but a beacon to those who are so poorly attuned to their own bodies and needs that they have forgotten what self-compassion looks like. Hold us in love as we resist the demands of this world. May it be so.
I read your first book, This Year Flesh, just after I was diagnosed with ME, or chronic fatigue syndrome, as you would know, and I was really intrigued in reading that, and then having having heard you talk about this on a number of occasions since, and I think at Greenbelt last summer there were a number of us who were here listening to you being interviewed there, and you talked quite a lot about the response and your experiences, and I wondered how your chronic illness had changed not just who you are as a person, but how it had changed how you write and how it had changed how you write liturgy. Has it made any difference there?
Yes. I think anyone that knows what it is to exist in a body that all of a sudden feels like a stranger to you, or if you have existed in kind of the mystery of the body, not knowing what's happening to you for any period of time, you know that it takes you to places in yourself that you otherwise would not go. I think being sick has a way of making you honest, you know. So for me, I was mostly in bed for about a year and on and off since in different seasons. And I have issues with my eyes, so I can't always rush to like the escapism of reality TV like I typically would. So I've spent a lot of time just by myself and listening to myself and not being able to escape or numb in the way that I have learned to since I was little. And I think it's made my writing more honest. I think I couldn't have written any kind of prayer that was real before I got sick. I was too far from myself. I was in some ways existing outside of myself in order to retain belonging in these spaces that didn't care about me, and actually hated me and my blackness and my queerness. And so I was so far from myself. And sickness, I don't mean to romanticize it, it's been terrible, but being sick has led to an interior honesty that it probably would have taken me a lot longer to find.
Thank you. We are coming to the end of our time. I actually wanted to end with a quote that doesn't come from this book, but comes from your previous book. It's something that I loved when I read it, and I've written it on numerous things since. It's the last page of This Year Flesh, and it says, "Flip the table and then repair it in time for the feast." Flip the table and then repair it in time for the feast. I wondered if you might just end by talking to us about something that you feel hopeful about. What is the feast that's for you?
I mean, I hate to give the cliche answer of children, but I've you know, had the benefit of hearing a child on and off throughout this time. And that in and of itself brings me a kind of peace, a kind of joy. I'm not a particularly joyful person. I have to be reminded by other people that it exists and that I can participate in it. My family is very joyful and exuberant and is like, Cole, stop crying. And I think children have most children have an unspoiled imagination and a real sense of wonder and beauty and delight and playfulness in the world. And it's not to say that they're unaware. I think children are a lot less naive as we believe them to be. I think there's deep wisdom there, but they have an ability to play and to dream up. I hate make-believe. The kids in my life force me to make-believe with them and pretend to be these things. And in that way, my imagination, my hope is resurrected.